Good morning, everybody. Good morning and happy Tuesday. What a beautiful day for us to be together. It's so wonderful to see you all. If we haven't met, my name is Lisa de Bonaventura, and it's my privilege to serve as the statewide director for Vision and Vision Loss Services for DDS. On behalf of our executive conference committee, Dr. Jean Ramsey, Dr. Barry Cran, Mary Zada, Ali Bull, and Georgia Wattendorf-Guiney, we'd like to welcome you to our 15th annual Focus on Vision Impairment and Blindness Conference. You know, we are deeply grateful to our generous sponsors, the Massachusetts Department of Developmental Services, the Commission for the Blind, Perkins School for the Blind, the DDS Southeast Region Training Council, the New England College of Optometry, and Shriver Clinical Services. You know, it takes a village, really a small army, to put a day like this together, and I am indebted to each and every one of the members of our volunteer and program planning committees. They really have done an amazing job for you today. We give our heartfelt thanks as well to all of our presenters and poster presenters and exhibitors and volunteers and musicians who collectively work to put the content for this whole day together. So please join me in a round of applause for everyone who's helped for this day. You know, we've been coming together for 15 years now, which is pretty exciting, and a lot has changed over 15 years, but what hasn't changed is that the prevalence of having a visual diagnosis, vision impairment, legal blindness, or deaf blindness among individuals who have intellectual disability or developmental disability. And that, of course, is why we're together. Today is a day for you to relax, to enjoy. Through Dr. Jane's keynote, we hope that you're going to find it as an invitation for you in all the great work that you do and that you're about to remember to take time to care for yourself. Today also, of course, is a day for learning and networking and sparking new ideas, all to benefit individuals who have vision loss. And we hope that throughout the day, there's going to be something that you'll be able to take back with you to inspire you personally, to share with your colleagues, or to inform your work with the individuals and the families that you serve. This morning, we've already gotten off to a fantastic start. There were interviews that were done here in the ballroom. So thank you to Dr. Cran and Roberta Luanis for starting us off. These interviews were recorded by the Talking Information Center Network, and they're going to be broadcast at a later time. My thanks as well to all the presenters. Mostly all of the sessions today are going to be audio recorded so that we can put them together for focus talks that will be up and available on our website. So my thanks to John Shea and the TIC crew. We very much appreciate it. You know, our work is collaborative, and we are continually inspired by your enthusiasm, your ideas, and your questions. I work from these to collaborate and develop resources that we hope meet the complexity of needs of the individuals that you serve. So please keep your ideas coming. There'll be an opportunity today for me to offer you a training survey. I invite you to fill it out. Please feel free to talk to me here today or call me or email me. We can set up a Zoom. I can come and visit. I love your questions and I love to learn from you. It really does guide my work and all of the work that we do collaboratively. So now just a couple housekeeping things before we really begin. If you need assistance today at all, please feel free to call upon me, any of the staff here at the Four Points, or any of our volunteers. A couple reminders is that we do have two session change locations for the 10 o'clock session. The CVI session will take place here in the ballroom, and the mentalizing session will take place in room 108-109. We know that a healthy conference is a happy conference, and so to that end, there are tissues in your tote bags, and there's hand sanitizer by the restrooms and also by the refreshment areas. And if you're in need of a mask, we have one of those for you too. So just let us know. If you're obtaining CEU credits, and I know someone has already asked me a question about that, in every room, like in this room, I don't see it because it's behind me, but there should be a number in the front of the room and a letter in the back of the room. And so the front number or letter will be your sign-in code, and then the back letter or number would be your sign-out code. Those will be announced in every room by the session room volunteers. And if you have any CEU questions, you can always stop by as well at the CEU information table. For lunch, behind your name tag, you're going to see a ticket. If you have a yellow ticket, that's for your chicken lunch. If you have a green ticket, that's because you ordered the vegan lunch. And if you have a white slip, that details your special meal choice. So you just have to give those to the server at lunch. A little before halfway through lunch, we're going to begin our award presentation. So I appreciate your attention then, of course, when you're eating, but I really do appreciate your attention. There are important presentations and awards. At the end of the day here in the ballroom, we're going to have a fantastic performance by the MAI band, and there'll be a raffle following that. You'll be able to get a free raffle ticket, here in the ballroom right before the raffle. And then finally, before you leave today, there is a conference evaluation in your yellow folder, and I really encourage you to fill that out. Again, I read them all. I really do. And I appreciate the time you'll take for that. And also, we're recycling the name tag holders, so if you can drop those both at the registration table. So I think that should do it for housekeeping needs. And now I have the pleasure of introducing Mary Zada. Mary's the Director of Professional Development at Perkins School for the Blind. She's been a supporter of this conference, a sponsor of this conference, sits on our executive committee, on our planning committee. She offers CEUs. We are just so indebted and grateful that you're here, Mary. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Lisa. Good morning, everyone. Oh, you can do better than that. Good morning. Yes. Excellent. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Felipe Jane. Dr. Jane is a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, as well as the director of Healthy Aging Studies at the Depression Clinical and Research Program. His research focuses on guided imagery and mindfulness practices for the treatment of depression and anxiety, with a special emphasis on family caregivers and biomarkers that may be used to personalize treatment. He has received research funding from the National Institutes of Health and private foundations to develop a new guided imagery and mindfulness treatment approach, which is called Mentalizing Imagery Therapy, that seeks to encourage perspective taking and other relationship skills. In addition to promoting well-being and reducing symptoms of depression and anxiety. Along with studying the therapeutic benefit of this approach, Dr. Jane studies how it impacts functional brain activation and brain structure using magnetic resonance imaging, MRI. More broadly, Dr. Jane studies how brain imaging markers, neurohormones, and the autonomic nervous system may be used to understand the depression and its response to treatment. Dr. Jane sees patients in clinical practice at the Depression Clinical and Research Program, and he supervises psychiatry residents in their training in the number one ranked Massachusetts General Hospital, McLean Hospital Psychiatry Residency Program at Harvard Medical School. He will also be offering a concurrent session as a follow-up to this keynote. Please join me in welcoming this really fascinating speaker. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And professionals who are caring for people with visual impairment, and that's the majority of the room. And I'd like to acknowledge that you're here not only because of the people in this room, but because of many influences that you've had over the course of your life, thank you, that have been very important to you, have been very important to your own personal development, have been important to you for your values, and that being here today is a manifestation of those values. It's about you seeking to take care of others in the best way that you can. And what we know is that in any relationship, including the relationship between someone who is partnering with an individual with a chronic illness or other type of condition or disability, and that caring for someone can involve a lot of emotions in ourselves and a lot of emotions in other people. And that caregiving is also a part of our normal life. Whenever we're in a relationship with someone, there's a natural give and take. There are times when we give to others, there are times when we receive. And what we're going to talk about today is very broad. It's very broad and it's really focused on how we both give and receive and what informs that. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your attention. Thank you to the conference organizers for their patience and for guiding me through this whole process, including getting here this morning, which was more difficult than anticipated, as it might have been for some of you as well. So now I'm going to figure out how this slide advancement works. Oops, I took it out of the slide presentation mode. So let me put this back. So to start, I'd like to tell you about some caregivers or care partners who are very close to me and important to me. And the man on the left is my uncle. And he served as the primary caregiver to my grandmother, who's also in the picture, for over a decade as she had dementia and the dementia progressed until she passed away at the age of 99. Very patient man. And my mother is the woman in the center of the image, and she took care of my father as he declined from brain cancer, which was also a slow and progressive process. And in that process, he lost his mobility, he lost his ability to think, he lost his ability to see, and ultimately, he passed away but was surrounded by his family. And so we were so grateful for my mom to take care of him so much, really to the end. So this caregiving journey is very natural. It's very natural both as professionals and as family members. And it evokes things that we all share in common. And so I'd like to ask you, and I know I'm supposed to be presenting to you, but I would like to hear from people in the audience, what for you is the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear this question? What do we all share in common?
Compassion.
Empathy. The feeling of being connected. So these are wonderful qualities and wonderful traits that sometimes we're able to experience very strongly, and sometimes we feel so worn out, so burnt out, although that term can be overused, that it can be hard to experience some of those emotions. And I'm going to bring this a little broader draw some inspiration from others here. So Wendell Berry said, the earth is what we all have in common. And to me, this evokes that theme of connectedness that someone mentioned. Another, people have one thing in common. They're all different. That's also important to remember, right? That we have our individual differences and quirks that inform who and how we are. And I particularly like this quote from Stephen Covey, who's a very inspirational writer and author of numerous books, including The Habits of Highly Effective People. And he said that every human has four endowments: self-awareness, conscience, which speaks to the empathy and compassion pieces we were hearing, independent will, and creative imagination. These give us the ultimate human freedom, the power to choose, to respond, and to change. And really, this is what I think we all seek. We all seek that power for ourselves, that power to choose, that power to respond, that power to change. And Mr. Covey highlights here that both self-awareness is an important part of this, as is creative imagination. And what I'm going to talk to you about today are techniques of creative imagination, ways of using your imagination to help yourself on this journey to what we really all have in common, which is that self-awareness. We have differences in the manifestation of our bodies, of our personas, of everything, but there's also this very bare basic experience of consciousness, of awareness, of conscience, of will. And yet, at the same time, in our day-to-day lives, we're very limited, and we experience ourselves as very limited, really because of that structure in red here, the human brain. And the human brain is hardwired for many, many different experiences, as you know, as you experience on a day-to-day basis. And this could be any of us, I feel, as we age. This was a woman whom I worked with, a woman who was in some of our classes and in some of our research studies. She was a 70-year-old retired physician. So she was a professional caregiver who had been taking care of patients in the emergency room for her whole life. As you could imagine, that was quite wearing for her. And her husband was several years older than she, and when she was in her 60s, he started to develop symptoms of memory loss, which progressed to the point of dementia. And she needed to take care of his daily needs. Now, this was not what she had anticipated, and she was resentful of some of what she had to do to help him. Now, at the same time, she loved him. She was so grateful to him. She knew he had been helpful to her. Over the course of time, over the course of her life, he had been there for her. And so she also felt that it was a privilege to be in this changing relationship with him and to be there for him in his time of need. And yet at the same time, there were so many complications. There were so many ways in which she had to adjust herself. And this wasn't his fault. It was simply a consequence of this illness, which was really neither of their faults, really. It was just, again, a limitation of the brain. So she became depressed as she was reflecting on her life and her husband's condition and what lay ahead for both of them. She couldn't sleep well. She felt anxious much of the time. And she had tried many things. She'd tried several antidepressant medications. She'd tried several forms of therapy, couples counseling, caregiver support groups, many different ways of trying to achieve what Stephen Covey had talked about, that sense of freedom to choose, that sense of freedom to respond. Now, her story has a happy ending, and I'll tell you more about that, but before I do, I want to tell you some of the keys that helped her to get to that happy ending. So the three important strategies, or key strategies, I'm going to tell you about to manage really complicated, stressful relationship situations, including those whom we're caring for professionally or personally as family members, are mindfulness, mentalizing, which I'll define both of these terms, and using creative imagery to really facilitate the first two qualities. So to start off, what is mindfulness? Well, I think it's helpful first to look at mindfulness, which is a term that's been in the news a lot lately. It's been in Time magazine. It's on the cover of various other magazines in the checkout counter of every grocery store these days, it seems like. But it's an ancient practice. It emerges from Buddhism, and it's... Despite emerging from Buddhism, it is non-religious in nature. It's more psychological in nature, and it has become a very important part of mainstream psychology these days. So in its original formulation from one of the earliest Buddhist texts called the Satipatthana Sutta, the way in which the Buddha's words were taken down were, quote, here... When feeling a pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unpleasant feeling. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in this world. So, what strikes me when I hear this quote is... not a state without feeling. There are still unpleasant feelings. There are still pleasant feelings. But the person who is mindful is in a state of observing. Observing how those feelings rise, how those feelings fall, how they come, how they go, how they change, and how they evolve. So these various feelings are not limiting for the person. They exist in that realm of self-awareness, that realm of self-awareness that Stephen Covey was talking about, and yet from a state of observation, of even, you could say, more intensive observation of self and of experience. Experience of that quality of awareness and all of the various manifestations of awareness, all of those things that we tend to feel, all of those objects of awareness, whether they be our thoughts, our feelings, our bodies, other people around us. Now, mindfulness was adapted was adapted for a Western psychological concept, for a Western psychological audience, really, by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And it was simplified in that process. And so in Jon Kabat-Zinn, who he was at the University of Massachusetts, he described it as paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. So in Kabat-Zinn's formulation of mindfulness, we still have the observing aspects of it. It's a focus on what we're experiencing in the present moment and knowledge of that. And you could say there's a certain distance from it. We're observing it and knowing that it's not us, that it's a phenomenon that comes and that goes. And mindfulness practices, as Jon Kabat-Zinn taught them to help facilitate the development of this observational state of being, included stretching and yoga, meditation practices, and daily awareness. And these practices form some of the basis for the most common mindfulness-based interventions that are offered, such as mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which help to focus the individual on entering this kind of a mindful state. And those interventions have been shown to help reduce depressive symptoms, reduce anxiety, help people to cope with chronic illness and chronic pain. These are very important interventions. They're very helpful, and I recommend that people do them. Now, what struck me about them when I was actually in my clinical training as a psychiatry resident, and I was myself dealing with the challenge of learning how to relate to my patients, how to understand them, how to empathize with them, how to help them. And then also, I was at home and newlywed and trying to figure out how to manage a marriage and how to manage the stresses in a marriage when I was busy and my wife, who's a neurologist now, was busy with her stuff and her comings and goings, and it wasn't always roses, right? But we're still married, and we've been able to work things out, and I'd say that these techniques that I developed, I also learned from. And I developed them because mindfulness was not the whole story of relationships. Mindfulness was an important piece. It was this important piece of observing, of being present, of being centered. But it wasn't putting myself into my wife's shoes. It wasn't putting myself into my patient's shoes. It wasn't deeply grappling with their reality as they experienced it. Those were not a part of the practices within the existing mindfulness-based interventions at the time. So I began to think about principles of mentalization, which I was also learning about in residency. And mentalization is really how we understand ourselves, and it's how we understand others. It's that whole process. It's how we know why people do what they do. So the motivations behind the actions. Let's say someone was supposed to call us and they didn't. For some people, that's an extraordinarily difficult situation. They think that the person hates them, or that they're ignoring them, or perhaps even maliciously teasing them by setting up an expectation and not following through. For others, they have a more complex theory of mind. They're able to step back and say, okay, maybe their phone died, or maybe they forgot because they were stressed out about something else. They're able to better put themselves into another person's shoes. Mentalization is about the interplay. It's about knowing how we affect others' mental states and how their mental states come to affect us. And it pertains to this whole domain of human interaction between ourselves and others. So our feelings, our thoughts, our desires, our needs, our goals, how we understand that interplay. So for example, let's say that there was a goal, perhaps a training program that we wanted to do, and we didn't end up doing it. Why not, right? Do we tell ourselves it's because, you know, I was stressed out? Do we say it's because I didn't really want to do it? How do we understand that kind of situation? Or how do we understand, I didn't think I was going to come here this morning, but I ended up doing it. I woke up and I pulled myself out of bed and I got here. Wonder how many people are in that situation. Now, oops, oh no, okay. Mentalization relies on connectivity among numerous brain regions. And I'm not going to go into all of them. One of the most famous is in green. And on this right one, I'm going to circle it. One of the most famous brain regions here is called the amygdala, which is really important not just for fear, which you might have learned about, but is important for processing any strong emotions, including in the social setting. Now, the amygdala is not thought of as a region that underpins mentalizing. It's thought of as a region that essentially prevents it from happening. So the regions in blue are more mentalizing regions in the prefrontal cortex and the parietal cortex toward the back of the brain and the intersection of the temporoparietal junction, which is between the parietal cortex and the temporal lobes of the brain. The reason that I'm mentioning this is that this very complex connectivity is necessary for us to be able to mentalize. And what the amygdala does with this is it actually sends inhibitory connections. So when we have a strong emotion, it's actually more difficult for us to understand other people and even to understand ourselves. So for example, if I get very angry, for example, at something that my 10-year-old has done, then it's quite difficult for me to reset and to truly enter his world. I'm more tempted to be reactive in some kind of way that I've learned, some kind of fight or flight learned response. And so you can see that with a practice like mindfulness, mindfulness could be very helpful to set the frame for mentalizing, because if you can enter a more observing state, then you may have the capacity to shift perspectives, because your amygdala is not going to be sending negative messages to turn off the prefrontal cortex. Instead, it's going to be quieter and allowing the rest of your brain to work. So this is an example of someone who was in a very complicated relationship situation. Marge Simpson, who seemed to vacillate between one of these emotions and the other, feeling somewhat desperate, down, and hopeless, and feeling quite angry for understandable reasons. And she was someone whose amygdala constantly triggered and inhibited the mentalizing circuits from being activated. So I'm going to come back to Marge in just a moment, but before I do, I want to turn to the third principle, which is that of creative imagery. So how do we really get into another person's head, right? We can't observe that with the eyes. we have to go through another process, and that process is imaginative in nature. And when you think about creative imagination, or sometimes people will call it visualization, which is something of a misnomer, or imagery, normally you think about a visual image. But creative imagination is not limited to that. And in fact, sometimes the visual part of it is beside the point. So, for example, one creative image you could make would be, imagine the taste of an apple. Imagine the crunch of it, the texture in your mouth, the smell. So there are many ways in which imagination works, and an important part of it is generating the feeling sense of what it is that we've experienced and what it is that we've gone through, and the feeling sense of what others are going through. So I'm particularly sensitive to this, given that here we are at a conference about caring for people with visual impairment, and I'm talking about guided imagery, but a mental image can involve any of the senses. It could be about odor. It could be about taste. It could be about hearing. It could be about the sound of that apple crunching. It's not just about visual images. And imagery can be used in many ways. And you may be familiar with imagery in these ways, such as using it to remember a moment of gratitude. In fact, I would invite you all in this moment to, even if you would like, to close your eyes and to take a breath and simply to remember something that you're grateful for, something that someone may have done for you or facilitated for you. And as you do that, notice what senses come to mind in that image. Is it all visual? Is there some about feeling sense? Is there some about other senses? And you can imagine yourself in nature. You can imagine the scent of the forest, the sound of the water, the sights that you might experience. You can imagine how you would like these qualities of gratitude or of peace that you experience in nature to manifest in your future. I'd invite you to return your attention to the room around and open your eyes. So there are so many ways that we can use creative imagery. And in the practices that I've developed, we use it to facilitate mentalizing for ourself and other understanding. So I'll tell you more about those in a moment. And I just want to revisit this quote once again. Every human has four endowments. Self-awareness, which you just experienced as you closed your eyes. Conscience, independent will, which you manifested in the choice to create an image, to go through this process. And creative imagination. These give us the ultimate human freedom, the power to choose, to respond, to change. So with that in mind, I'd like to return to Marge. And in this situation, Marge perceives a stressor. Now, many of us might not have to deal with this stressor, but I'd like you for a moment to use your creative imagination to call out a few possibilities for why Homer might be in the state that he's in. So someone said drunk, I think. Okay, so he might be drunk. That was my first assumption, too, when I saw this. I'm not sure I saw the actual episode, so I can't tell you for sure. So, he might be drunk, that's true, but now let's go a little bit beyond that, using our mentalizing. Let's put ourselves more in Homer's shoes, possibly. Okay, what's another option?
Maybe he just finished
taking care of his grandkids. Or maybe Homer slapped him with his skateboard. What else? Maybe he just had a neurological event and he fell backwards. I mean, there are so many possibilities here for why Homer could be in the situation that he's in that are not readily apparent. And so if Marge's amygdala gets really hot here and she's unable to consider various possibilities, then she's going to respond from an automaticity. And that automaticity might not be what, in retrospect, she would have wanted, particularly if Homer did have a neurological event. So Marge here has to consider why. Right, and she has to then evaluate how to respond on the basis of that why. And to do that, she requires, you know, Marge, she needs a lot of mindfulness. You know, and hopefully she comes out of this and she feels like she can handle the problem. Right, hopefully she doesn't come out of this feeling angry, upset, desperate, hopeless, like my caregiver, whom I shared with you about toward the beginning. But in order to help herself to be better at this process, she needs to learn more skills, because no one is prepared for this. No one, human beings used to live to an average age of about 40. Right? They didn't used to live to an average age of about 70, 75, 80. And the biggest risk factor for a condition such as dementia is aging. Our brains didn't truly evolve to deal with some of the very chronic illnesses of aging that we and our family members may experience, and to care for them, certainly not to care for them in our contemporary environment with fragmentation of families, with one or two people being involved instead of being in larger extended family networks. Our brain it's not equipped to handle that. It's really, really, really difficult. It's extraordinarily stressful. And so part of the solution is managing the external world. Part of the solution can also be managing the internal world, learning some of those ways to reach the faculties, really, that Stephen Covey was talking about. And so let's turn to mentalizing imagery therapy as one way to help, as one way to learn some of these skills. Mentalizing imagery therapy, which I'll abbreviate as MIT to make it sound incredibly smart, it aims to improve mindfulness. It aims to improve mentalizing. It uses creative imagery to focus on self-awareness and on connectedness. In the format that we've studied it for caregivers has involved 4 weekly 2-hour sessions and home practice of about 30 minutes per day, which in practice is completed 4 to 5 times per week. Now, here are some of the exercises. Some of the exercises are about stress reduction and focusing on awareness. They're about building mindfulness, that capacity to observe in those difficult situations. And so those include practices such as stretching and breathing. And as we do so, we remember what the various body parts that we're moving, for example, our hands or our legs, what it is that they've done for us, what it is that they've done for us over the prior day, how they've helped us, how they've enabled us to do things, what it is that they've done for us over the prior week, what it is that they've done for us over the course of our lifetime. So we use that imagery to remember, to have gratitude for the body, for what it does. You know, I did this last night. I woke up in the middle of the night. I was anxious from a dream. I have someone in my family who has mental health difficulties, and that had been very stressful last night. So I woke up, I was anxious, and I got out of bed, I went to the bathroom, I started doing these stretching exercises. I started remembering the things my body had done. And I realized, you know, it's very important, even that I just have a body, even that I just have a body that can move. I want to put more attention on that. I want to value that more. I want that to be a part of my experience, not just entirely consumed by the stress of what's going on in this one situation. I want to have a greater experience, and my body is a part of that. And so we use these stretching and breathing exercises to help with that. We've also adapted this for Spanish language populations in Latino individuals, and oftentimes it's their very first exposure to these kinds of stretching and breathing practices. They have all sorts of benefits. Their back pain goes away. Their headaches diminish just by focusing on the body, by becoming more observant and more grateful for the body in the moment. So another practice is that of centering awareness, bringing our awareness inside to a central region of the body that we define as midway between the bottom of the spine and the top of the head toward the back. So these are mindfulness practices, and then we move beyond mindfulness to mentalizing, in which we use creative imagination to go through experiences that have been challenging for us from our own perspectives and from that of other people's perspectives, including, for example, someone with memory impairment, someone whose mind is very challenging for us to understand. And we use this creative process to imagine ourselves in the context of our world, of nature, of all of those gifts that we have from nature, to remember our connectedness with things. And, for example, to imagine how other people in our communities, our work communities, our neighborhoods, how they experience things. Not only what it's like for us to be a part of the group, but what it's like for them as they enter these. What are their experiences, their anxieties, their hopes, their wishes, their dreams? And we use that to situate ourselves in the context of ourselves, of our family, our community, of our world. Part of this emerges not only from the Buddhist or mindfulness stream of thought, but also on the basis of the preceding wisdom that the Buddha drew from, which was in the Upanishads, the sacred texts of India, in which the earliest meditation instructions were to focus on the inner light within the heart. Now, this is a metaphor. The inner light within the heart is not a physical light. It's that consciousness, it's that self-awareness that Stephen Covey points to. And in the Upanishads, it states, this chest contains wealth, in it this whole universe rests. By that, it meant that connectedness of our own consciousness with the things around us. And so, drawing on this kind of inspiration, we do the imagery, the creative imagery practices, involve the body, involve the world, and shift perspectives. Now, when caregivers experience this, they say things like, it gave me a kind of rudder. I was floundering and it centered me. It makes the highs and lows more manageable so I don't get pissed off and feel hopeless and totally drained. It allowed me to comfort myself. That was a kind of revelation. I'm a better listener now. I'm more present now. I've become more aware of my mother's feelings, putting myself in her place. I think my overall view of life and the world is not so grim. So here we see manifesting those qualities of mindfulness, that mentalizing, putting themselves in the other's place, and that connectedness, using that creative imagination to remember our connectedness. Now, our most recently published trial was covered by a number of news outlets in the field, and I'm going to describe it to you a bit in depth so that you can see what some of the quantitative results and even some of the brain imaging results were from our study. So this was a randomized controlled trial of MIT funded by the National Institute on Aging with 46 family caregivers, so people who were really living with people with dementia and helping them and assisting them through their activities, such as the woman I mentioned previously. They were randomly assigned to MIT or to a support group in which they could share what they were going through, and there were also psychoeducational principles so they could learn more about dementia. So this was a very active control condition. This was not a wait list. This was what is the most widely available therapy for caregivers. We studied effects on negative psychological symptoms, on positive psychological traits, and looked at neuroimaging to understand resting state brain connectivity. And I'm going to tie that back to the previous brain that we saw. I'll just say that about 70% of the participants were white, and about 30% were from minoritized groups. On average, they were highly educated, and they had been caring on average for several years for their relatives, and they were in their 60s on average. So what we saw in terms of a pattern of improvement was really quite interesting. And I'm going to go through this somewhat. I wonder if the mouse here would... You can't see the mouse. Okay, so I'm going to describe the results here. So base at the bottom left refers to baseline before they were randomized. And depression scores were equivalent. Depression scores are on the y-axis, this QIDS, quick inventory of depressive symptoms. And then during the 4 weeks of the groups, depressive symptoms went down the same in both groups. Both seem to benefit from the social support, from the camaraderie, from being together. But then by the post-group assessment, abbreviated here PG, which was just a week to 2 weeks later, the support group had started to rebound in terms of their depressive symptoms, whereas MIT essentially maintained its level of improvement. And at our four-month follow-up, again, you could see this divergence where the support group had largely recrudesced, had relapsed once again. And we saw this in terms of clinician-rated symptoms, anxiety, perceived stress, the same pattern favoring MIT. In terms of positive psychological traits, we saw improvements with MIT that outdid support in mindfulness, in self-compassion, in overall well-being, even in happiness, about in response to a single question of how happy do you feel, people showed about a 25% improvement in 4 weeks. That's a pretty substantial result, particularly as it was maintained 4 months later. And we actually had objective findings supporting these improvements. So in terms of neuroimaging, one of the things that I told you when we were looking at the brain circuitry before was that the connectivity between the prefrontal regions involved in mentalizing would get disrupted by strong emotions. Well, what we saw in MIT was that this connectivity between prefrontal regions involved in regulating emotions, planning, attention, goal setting, being able to choose in the words of Stephen Covey, being able to choose, that connectivity increased in MIT, and it didn't change in the support group, and that connectivity strength correlated with depression. If it got to be higher, then depression went down, and it correlated with increasing mindfulness. If the connectivity strength went up, people were better able to observe. Right? So our biology and our inbuilt responses is not our destiny. We can learn new skills. You know, my next participant is going to be Marge. I'm up for the challenge. I'm going to take on Marge to go with this. Okay, so as I mentioned, many of our caregivers were highly educated previously. We've done some initial work with Latino patients who are Spanish language only. Well, actually for the caregivers, and these 60% had a high school education, but they were not people of higher educational attainment. And they loved the program. There was 100% attendance in our virtual groups. They practiced these imagery practices at home. Their multi-component satisfaction was a 19 out of 20 on average, and they showed similar results. So now we're moving this into the mobile application and virtual delivery realm. This is upcoming. If you know someone who would be interested in potentially receiving these kinds of techniques via a mobile app, you can email us at thiscaregivers@mgb.org. Or if you would even just like to access some of the MIT techniques on your own, you can do so. So this was a website that I put up during COVID because I wanted people outside of the research trials and my clinical setting to be able to have access to some of these techniques. So this is fernhillcenter.org. It's called fernhillcenter.org, and it's an entirely free website that has some of the audio recordings that I use even in my studies. So before I get to summary, I'd just like to tell you the outcome of that one caregiver that I spoke about before. So what she said was that as she went through this mentalizing imagery process, she said the idea of it really struck her because she wasn't learning to observe her husband clinically, but she was learning to observe him more objectively. But it wasn't just objectively, it was subjectively. It was subjectively from his perspective, and then herself more objectively, in the interplay between them. And what she learned through that process was that she was extremely perfectionistic with him, and she expected him to be able to do so many things that he couldn't do, and that she could let that go through entering her perspective more deeply and remember more their connection, remember more all of the ways in which he'd been there for her, in which he still loved her, and in which they were together. And her depression entered remission by the end of the study. And she said it wasn't a complete turnaround in 4 weeks for her life, but she felt like she knew the direction she wanted to go. So she felt that greater sense of will and that ability to choose, even though nothing in her external situation had changed. Her spouse still had dementia. He was still going to worsen over time. But she was able to develop more self-awareness and to use her imagination better. So the three key strategies that I've talked to you about today for helping caregivers and others in challenging situations are mindfulness, mentalizing, and creative imagery. And using these tools can help return us to what we all share, that sense of self-awareness, that consciousness, that creative imagination, even our differences. You know, you'll notice that in that story of my caregiver, she recognized how he was different. And it wasn't just he should be the way that she expected him to. She was able to really recognize those differences. That's a part of mentalizing. And also connectedness, that larger connectedness. So I will stop there. And thank you very much for your attention this morning.